with a public hearing on HCR 7. House Concurrent Resolution 7. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. HCR 7 comes here from Representative Avakian, and it declares May 2nd to May 8th, 2005 is Jury Appreciation Week in Oregon.
Thank you. And we have people signed up to talk on this, and I will actually find the sign-up sheet. Natasha Ernst and Marilyn Koval. Odell. Marilyn Odell. I know Marilyn Odell. Your handwriting has not improved.
No, sorry about that.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Hello. For the record, my name is Natasha Ernst. I'm Chief of Staff for Representative Brad Avakian and myself a former juror. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for hearing HCR 7 today. As you know, jurors serve a vital part of our judicial system. And when we think of jurors, we often think of the people sitting in the little juror box, making the decision, deciding the case, handing in the verdict. But for every one of those individuals, there are thousands of people who just go in and fulfill their duty and never have the privilege of sitting on an actual jury. I was one of those people. I served my two full days at my local circuit court and was never picked for a jury. But I came in every day, I stood in the long, long lines, got through security, read outdated magazines, did crossword puzzles, did some random other 5,000-piece puzzles, talked to people, gave my time, got my $10 check, and went home. HCR 7 has taken on a life of its own. Once people found out that the legislature was going to pass a resolution appreciating juries, it's caught fire across the state. Currently, there are many, many activities planned for Jury Appreciation Week, and lawyers, judges, jurors across the state will know that their legislature appreciates them, even if day-to-day you don't always feel like you're the most appreciated person in the world. So thank you very much for your time. I'll answer any questions you have. And thank you for your vote for HCR 7.
Thank you. You identified yourself as a former juror.
Mm-hmm.
When did you serve on a jury?
In the summer of 2003 in Multnomah County Court.
Jury is pretty good now because they just get you in for a two-day period.
Yes.
And I've been called a number of times myself. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Marilyn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marilyn Odell. I'm a Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice, but I'm here today as Chair of the Oregon State Bar's Judicial Administration Committee, and I'm testifying on behalf of the Oregon State Bar in support of House Concurrent Resolution 7. Jury service, like voting, is the cornerstone of our democracy. It's the most important way that our citizens participate in our government. Without citizens who are willing to give their time to our justice system, it wouldn't function. Honoring those citizens who say yes when they receive their summons, despite their busy lives and personal obligations, is but a small token of appreciation for a huge contribution. I would commend HCR 7 to you and urge your support. We hope that this will be just a first step in a series of efforts to show jurors that we truly appreciate their commitment of time, which is very important to all of us in our busy lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there, Senator Brzezinski?
Thank you, Marilyn. Wouldn't it be better if we just actually raised the rate that we actually pay jurors to show how much we really appreciate them instead of a piece of paper that no one's going to see?
Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski, certainly raising the rate that jurors are paid would be an important show of appreciation, and I'm sure that this committee has seen the cost comparisons of what the value of the $10 a day that we give jurors now is compared to the year that it was adopted, which is now worth about $2 in the 19, I believe it was the late 80s that rate was adopted. I think that's very important. But the other thing that's very important is that people be encouraged to say yes to it. And I think that these kinds of things do go a long ways towards helping that.
Other questions from the committee?
Thank you.
All right. We will. That's all who signed up. Would anybody else like to speak on this bill? Okay. We will close the hearing on HCR 7, and we will open a work session on HCR 7. Senator Starr.
Chair, I move House Concurrent Resolution 7 to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Concurrent Resolution number 7 to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Pazanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be supporting the resolution, but I think it's really pretty dismal that that's all we're going to be doing. And we've had this discussion at least since I've started serving in the legislature, and yet today we're still asking jurors to come in, which is part of their civic duty, but understanding the cost of just child care, let alone parking in many cases. It seems like we could actually help offset some of those costs and really show true appreciation for the time that they do have to take away from their jobs and their families.
So noted. Any objection? So ordered. HCR 7 to the Senate floor, and this will coincide, hopefully, with May 2nd to 8th, 2005, which is Jury Appreciation Week in Oregon. Hopefully, we can get this through the process by then, since it's past the House. Council?
Carry on.
I'll carry this. Okay. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1025. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1025, if I remember correctly, comes to you from the Committee on Rules, and it modifies the requirements for use, retention, and disclosure of genetic information in DNA samples.
Okay. Where's our sign up on here? Okay, we have Gwen Dayton and David Holt signed up, and maybe Mary Durham, although I can't tell whether that's part of this panel.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. For the record, I'm Gwen Dayton. I am here in my capacity as co-chair of the Advisory Committee on Genetic Privacy and Research. It is the goal of my testimony this morning to explain, or this afternoon, to explain to you all what this bill does, what the existing law is, and how this bill might change existing law. I am very pleased to have at the table with me, though, some very esteemed researchers who are far more expert in the day-to-day world of research and can answer some of those questions for you probably better than I. This legislation does come to you from the Advisory Committee on Genetic Privacy and Research. This advisory committee is composed of a broad variety of stakeholders on the issue, hospitals and other providers, the biosciences industry, the Department of Human Services, consumers, the ACLU, and others. And we had extensive conversation in the advisory committee about the topic of research and whether or not the existing law in Oregon was really working, and if there is something that we should bring to the legislature to make changes to that law that would at the same time provide adequate protections for the subject of research. And after those conversations, we brought to you Senate Bill 1025. In summary, what this bill does is modify the existing requirements for informed consent for research under certain limited circumstances. We take advantage of existing federal law protections for research, basically impose those laws in Oregon. Let me talk briefly about what these existing laws are, and then I'll talk to you about what Senate Bill 1025 does to those laws. Oregon genetic privacy law currently requires informed consent by all most subjects of genetic research. The only significant exception is those subjects of anonymous research, which is research that simply cannot be identified to anyone. Those individuals can give informed consent, but are also allowed to give to simply opt out from research if they choose to. The federal common rule also requires informed consent for genetic research, but there are procedures in this federal law to waive or alter that consent requirement. IRBs will review all genetic research in Oregon, and the IRB, Institutional Review Board, can waive or alter the informed consent requirement if the research involves only minimal risk to the subject, if the waiver or the alteration will not adversely affect their rights or welfare, and the research can't be practically carried out without the waiver or the alteration, and the subjects will be provided with additional information after participation if it's appropriate. So all research currently is subject to the federal common rule, and the federal common rule allows an IRB to waive the informed consent requirement if these fairly restrictive requirements are met. The other significant federal law that applies to research is, of course, the HIPAA privacy regulations. HIPAA, as many of you have probably heard more often than you would like, covers healthcare providers, insurers, and healthcare clearinghouses. So it doesn't cover the entire field of research, but it does certainly cover healthcare providers and the research they do. HIPAA is very similar to the federal common rule. It requires authorization for research, but it does provide for a waiver of that authorization if conditions are met. And the conditions that HIPAA expresses are quite similar, quite parallel to the federal common rule. Essentially, minimal risk, the waiver of the alteration won't harm the individual, the research really can't be done without it, and that research can't practically be conducted without access to and use of that information. So HIPAA and the federal common rule are aligned. So the situation that we have now, as you think about these three sets of rules, Oregon law requires informed consent for research in virtually all circumstances other than anonymous research. Federal law, however, requires the consent, but it contains procedures for waiver of that consent. That's where Oregon and federal law are different right now. What Senate Bill 1025 does is it takes advantage of those federal procedures. It says in Section 3 of the bill, we are reflecting very expressly the HIPAA requirements. We're saying that if you are a covered entity under HIPAA, you can essentially do research as HIPAA would allow you to do. You have to get informed consent unless there are grounds to waive or alter that informed consent. Elsewhere in the bill, we cover the broader range of researchers because, of course, not all researchers are covered entities. Not all researchers are healthcare providers under the law. So we needed a separate section to cover those people. So this bill also says that you can, if you are not a covered entity under HIPAA, if you're just if you're covered entities and non-covered entities, the whole world of researchers can do research as essentially is allowed by the federal common rule. You have to have consent. Nobody's saying that's not the first place you start. But if there are grounds to waive or alter that consent, then you can go through that procedure with an IRB. We do propose several amendments to the bill that to some degree reflect just some technical drafting issues that we saw with the bill, but there's one significant substantive issue that I'll raise with you. First, we found when we reviewed the bill as drafted that the word anonymous was used inappropriately in Section 3, where it just simply didn't belong, and so we requested an amendment to take that out. In Section 4, the section that deals with all entities doing research, it really should apply to coded research, not research generally. Coded research is research that can be identified to an individual. It's encrypted, but there is a key. There is a way to find out who the individual is. That was the intent of the advisory committee when we put together our bill concept, and we simply need to clarify that through amendment. The last amendment that I'll raise with you is we are respectful of concerns about consent and how subjects of research really do have a right to control the use of their own information. And so we suggest an amendment to the bill that requires, has an IRB or privacy board looking first to see whether alteration of that consent requirement is what ought to happen, rather than simply waiving it. Is there, can we provide consent but just alter it in some manner? Perhaps a phone call rather than written consent would be an example. Let's start with that, whether before we simply waive the consent requirement. And if that simply doesn't work, if that's not practical, then you can look at waiver. But you have to look at a mere alteration before you go to waiver. So we respectfully ask you to consider these amendments to the bill. And with that, I'll take any questions and perhaps refer to my colleagues for some of the real world application of some of these concepts.
Questions from the committee? I think maybe we'll wait till
that'd be fine.
Done. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is David Holt, and I'm the Director of the Research Subject Protection Office at Kaiser Permanente Northwest. I'm testifying on behalf of Kaiser Permanente today, and I'm offering testimony for Senate Bill 1025 and to provide further information about IRBs and what IRBs do. So basically, the Institutional Review Board system, as we know it, was set up by the National Research Act of 1974. It's encapsulated in the federal regulations, Title 45, Part 46.
These regulations have been adopted by a number of different federal agencies, and they often refer to as the common legal protection.
And they also set up federal oversight by two main federal bodies, the Food and Drug Administration and the Office of Human Research Protection. Both of these bodies monitor IRBs. They have adopted parallel regulations that govern the day-by-day running of the IRBs. They often do for-cause audits of institutional review boards, as well as ongoing monitoring audits. They investigate serious breaches of compliance on the part of IRBs or on the part of investigators, that is, researchers who are connected with research institutions. And they've even been known to close down research institutions when serious breaches of compliance have taken place, or they've considered that institutional review boards haven't done their job properly in protecting human subjects, because that's basically what IRBs are set up to do, to protect human volunteers or human participants in research. IRBs are charged with acting as independent bodies within the research institutions wherein they reside. So it's very important that the directors or the institutional officials of those institutions allow the IRBs independence to come to their decisions free of any institutional interference and free of conflict of interest. Under the regulations, investigators, researchers can't conduct their research studies without IRB approval. So institutional review boards have to review and approve any such research projects that are on their head. And IRBs are federally, under the federal regulations, are constituted of at least 5 voting members, including a non-scientific member and community members. And the community members on IRBs bring a very important aspect to the whole enterprise. They ensure that local ethical issues, local societal issues, and broader societal issues are brought to the table when the Institutional Review Board makes its decision on a research project. Basically, IRBs look at projects, they look at research projects to ensure that the risks to participants are minimized and that the benefits can be maximized, and to also ensure that people who get involved as research participants are truly volunteers. The whole basis of this is what's known as informed consent. And in most cases, IRBs look at what's called an informed consent document to ensure that everything that's involved in the participation in that particular research project is laid out in that research, in that informed consent document. So the participants are being properly and thoroughly informed by that document and aware of what their rights are before they get involved in any research projects. Now, in certain circumstances, however, IRBs can waive the requirement for written informed consent, written and signed informed consent on the part of the participants. And they have to go through the evaluation of four distinct criteria before that waiver can be put into place. The IRBs have to ensure that the research involves no more than minimal risk. The waiver or alteration will not adversely affect the subject's rights or welfare. The research could not practicably be carried out without waiver or alteration, and the subjects will be provided with additional pertinent information when necessary. So IRBs have to go through a very clear process of making those four findings and documenting them before they can waive the requirement for written, signed, and informed consent. Now, the key points here are two phrases: minimal risk and impracticable. What does it mean when a project is considered to be minimal risk? Well, it's actually defined in the regulations, which makes it easier. Minimal risk is defined in the regulations as where the probability and magnitude of harm or discomfort anticipated in the research are not greater in and of themselves than those ordinarily encountered in daily life or during the performance of routine physical or psychological examinations or tests. Impracticable, however, is not defined in the regulations, so there's room for a lot of interpretation between IRBs and also depending on the context of individual research projects as well. But impracticable is generally interpreted to mean extremely difficult to carry out the research or impossible, perhaps, to carry out the research in certain circumstances. So in Oregon, the state laws on genetic research do not allow for alteration or waiver of consent when the research involves or includes research on genetic information, such as results from genetic tests done as part of clinical care, or genetic material, such as DNA. This effectively means that when research includes genetic information or genetic analysis from these samples, IRBs can't waive the requirement for written, signed, informed consent, and this can effectively make the research project impossible to carry out. So that's my testimony. I'll be happy to take questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, are there questions from the committee? Thank you. I assume you're all going to stick around because this is very complicated stuff. So I want to hear some of the opposing testimony before we, before we make any decisions. Counselor, did you have a question?
Madam Chairman, Mr. Committee, sure. And Gwen, maybe you can help me with this, because when I look at the bill and I look at the current exception, the person conducting research shall seek the informed consent of the individual's representative for the purposes of subsection of the section. I'm reading from 192.535. What is the problem that you, is there a logistical problem here that you face with that particular provision?
Counsel Taylor, is your question why? What is the compelling need to depart from the existing requirement for consent?
What compelling needs, whatever.
Well, right now, Oregon does not have a provision in law allowing a waiver of that consent requirement.
Right.
There are circumstances that occur when obtaining consent is virtually impossible. That is the purpose of the IRB under the federal common rule and acting pursuant to HIPAA. They can look at those circumstances, decide if there's minimal risk to the subject of the research, and fulfill the other criteria or evaluate the other criteria that Mr. Holt and I have testified about to decide whether waiving the consent is the right thing to do. Will it harm the person at all? If it will not and research will be advantaged, then they may make the choice to waive it. Under Oregon law, there's no opportunity to waive it, so sometimes research simply can't be done because you can't give the required, you can't obtain the required notice from the subject of the research.
And Chairman of the Committee, Grant, could you give us some examples when it would be impossible to...
Chair Burdick, I might defer that defer that question to the others at the table to provide some real-world examples of when that comes up.
Some members of the committee, you might have an example for where a researcher is trying to do a retrospective study, look at data only, as opposed to actually having interaction with subjects. And in that case, there may be 5,000 or 6,000 or more, for example, participants, people whose data is being examined and analyzed. It would be impracticable, it would be impossible to go and find those 5,000 or 6,000 people and get them to sign an informed consent document.
Before you move on to another example, is there any way that this data can be traced back to an individual? And we're all worried about, you know, the data falling into the wrong hands and being used to harm someone, you know, insurance underwriting being an obvious one.
Chair Burdick, my testimony does cover some of these areas, although my name is Mary Durham. May I proceed with my testimony?
Why don't you go ahead and then we'll move from there.
Chair Burdick, Judiciary Committee members, my name is Mary Durham. I represent Kaiser Permanente, and I'm here offering testimony in support of Senate Bill 1025. Perhaps I can address some of those issues. Health research is aimed to benefit the public, and we contribute knowledge in many ways that the public highly values, but more and more that information includes genetic information. To be able to continue that benefit to the public, researchers need to be able to conduct effective and scientifically sound research that includes that genetic information. Let me kind of jump to the answers to your questions. Under the Oregon Genetic Privacy Law, all human subjects research must give consent for genetic research or for anonymous research be notified and give the option to opt out. Let me give some examples. If we are doing research, in most instances when, for example, blood samples might be taken for a genetic test, those happen in the course of practice. They're not happening because a research project is going on. An individual might be seeking a diagnosis for some symptoms, and their blood is drawn or a test is done in the doctor's office for that purpose. It isn't till later that a researcher might come on the scene for a couple of reasons. One, the information making the blood test for the genetic test for which there is no informed consent that's happening as a part of clinical practice is done in that clinical setting. It may be later that my daughter or your son and daughter or the researchers on our staff become interested in a question that involves genetic information. And it's long past the time that the information was actually captured in the clinician's office.
If I could just interrupt right there with a question. When that happens, they've got a blood sample and they've saved it somewhere. And when that happens and it's turned over for research, is there a name attached to that?
It is at that point that the information can be separated so that information might not be associated with the blood sample. But there's also instances when it's necessary to go back and get historical information. If you only have the results of a test, you may need for a research project to know other information, family history, or other parts of diagnosis, accompanying diagnoses, and so forth. And so it is at the point of the IRB that the IRB really scrutinizes how much information that the researcher needs to know. And that's why we are in support of having the IRB sort out that situation. But the fact of the matter is that at the moment that the blood sample is drawn, in using the example of the blood sample, the research project isn't even formulated. It may be something that's formulated far in the future. And so to get specific informed consent at that moment, at the time that the blood is drawn, is simply not possible. The research project is not even yet imagined. Let me give you some...
Senator Pisansky, yes.
Madam Chair, just following up on what you asked. I mean, in 1995, when we looked at this, one of the responses I remember, we asked if this was anonymous. We were told, yes, it's anonymous, but we can always find the people if we need to. And this is basically what I'm hearing. If necessary, they have a way, so they can do the cross-check, and you can tie it back to that sample, to that individual.
Senator Burdick, Senator Prozenic, the catch in that instance is that some of the studies that we do are studies that involve tens of thousands, maybe a million people in some diseases. And so the practicality issue is the one that's been mentioned here. It may not be practical to go back and get informed consent from those tens of thousands, maybe a million people, whose information might be used in the course of a study.
Madam Chair. But have you done any research, or have you gotten research as to how people would feel if you asked them at the very beginning, oh, we're drawing blood from you. Oh, by the way, we're going to keep a sample. We don't know when or how we might use it, but sometime in the future we may want to use your blood for a sample for some research.
Senator Prosasnik, I'm sorry,
Prosasnik.
Sorry. I'm not familiar with any published information, although I'm certain we could look for that for you. But for in great large part, people are very interested in doing medical research. The public is highly interested in medical research. But in these instances, it's simply not practicable to go back and ask them one-on-one regarding that question for a study that may be very far in the past after that happens.
Thank you.
Okay. The kind of research that I'm really referring to here is a bit different than the research that you may think of as the white coat collecting clinical studies in a clinic. Much of the research that we're talking about here is health services research or medical economics, where valuable information is given and provided so that doctors and researchers and healthcare systems can find ways to improve health. I thought I'd give you some examples here because these are examples where research is done from very large databases. We've developed ways to better help people with diabetes control their blood sugar and prevent diabetes such as heart attack, blindness, and amputations. We've developed methods for increasing the percent of women who have regular mammograms by looking at these very large databases to see if we can diagnose breast cancer early and prevent breast cancer. And this wasn't a problem in the past because we simply didn't have genetic information as part of those databases. But now that we have genetic information, and that genetic information is growing in leaps and bounds, the amount of it that we have available, then we now have new questions that we can answer using these clinical databases. Let me give you some examples. How are people who have had genetic tests for inherited cancer susceptibility, are they getting the recommended follow-up? Does that recommended follow-up result in catching cancer earlier or preventing it altogether? Is genetic testing, for example, testing for genetic abnormalities in children with learning disability and learning problems, helping us to solve these problems and find cures for these very common problems? What are the health effects of specific chromosome abnormalities? All of these things, some of these questions, researchers in the field would tell you take very, very large databases. Once again, the issue that we're dealing with, where it's impossible to go back to tens of thousands, maybe a million people to be able to get their consent for that specific piece of work. And so really this is the crux of the issue. When that, I'm using the example of a blood specimen, but and I think that that's one that we're all experienced with. At the moment that that blood specimen is taken, you do not give consent. Many of these tests are taken without consent, and they're certainly not taken thinking about research in the future. They're being taken for a clinical reason, to make a diagnosis, solve a clinical problem. And so, therefore, it's unlikely that consent for research would ever take place at that moment, which means that we do have to go back retrospectively to look at that issue. Senate Bill 1025 provides the prospects for conducting important research in genetics in Oregon by changing the consent requirements for coded research. By using the IRB system, which my colleagues have spoken about, we can use the federal regulation that decides whether informed consent can be altered or waived, just as they do with research that does not include genetic information. So it's using that same standard. And so, therefore, once again, that research still has to pass muster through the IRB using four criteria. First, that it involves no more than minimal risk. Second, that the waiver or alteration will not adversely affect the subject's rights and welfare. Third, that the research could not practicably, as I've mentioned, be carried out without the waiver or an alteration, and then that the subjects will be provided with additional pertinent information after they participate whenever appropriate.
So before you move on, when you talk involving no more than minimal risk to the subjects, what kind of risk are you talking about?
For example, there could be risks of breach of confidentiality. That's one risk that's involved in almost any research project. Or there could be physical risks involved in clinical trials. Or there could be...
What kind of physical risks?
In a clinical trial setting where you have direct interaction with people and where interventions are going ahead, people can be put at physical risk. But where just an analysis of their blood samples, for example, is involved in a study, it would probably be the main risk would be breach of confidentiality, perhaps risks involved in getting health insurance.
Senator Burdick, the whole range, what we're dealing with in clinical trials, for example, is a whole range of risk, from surgical devices being implanted as a research process. That would never be considered minimal risk. So those are things that we're taking completely off the table here. When we're talking about a questionnaire or some piece of information where the coded research would allow us to conduct the research, but having set aside the identifiers and now having only the coded information, there may be very minimal risk associated with that. Certainly nothing on the order of the other examples that I gave where there might actually be physical risk. Those are off the table in this instance.
Well, how much good would it do for the research if you could have access to the data but have no way of accessing the connection to the actual person who provided the data?
Senator Burdick, that's exactly the way that much of this research would be done. The identifying information of person's name, a person's social security number, etc., would be stripped and set aside, and the researcher would not be dealing with that in many of these cases. They would only be using the pertinent information, for example, that might be thought by the researcher to be important in figuring out inherited susceptibility for cancer risk. And so the identity of that individual is probably not important in that instance. They may want to use identifying information to get other pieces of information like family history, etc., but the identity is, in that case that I mentioned, the name or the person's address or whatever, is coded and not given to the researcher. That's held aside so that only the relative information is then used in the analysis to actually do that analysis.
But if you were trying to build a confidence level, if you had a provision that that the data could be released as long as it's not tied to anything at all, and if, you know, if they wanted the family information and the person's name, et cetera, used access tied to the individual donor, then consent would be required. How useful would that be?
Senator Burdick, the factor here is the consent, which requires going back to that individual to say, can we use your data?
No, I understand that, but you have people who do give consent now for research.
Absolutely.
And that's, you know, I don't think anybody has a problem with that. The problem is when you get to the people who don't give consent, and that is, you know, you talk about minimal risk, but you're not talking about zero risk for people.
I think, Senator, it's a question of balancing the very minimal risk. You will never have zero risk because, as I said, you could have a risk of breach of confidentiality under certain circumstances. But balancing that against the greater good of allowing this kind of important research to go ahead. So it's a balancing act between very minimal risk and the greater benefit to society and perhaps to the individuals themselves of allowing the research to go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'm going to throw out a scenario and see if my nightmare is actually what I believe is happening. You go to your doctor, he or she says, you need to take a blood sample. They give you you go take the blood sample for whatever test they want to run. For whatever reason, part of that blood sample is maintained or at that point it somehow is utilized beyond what you consent it to and what you went in there for the first time for the test, and all of a sudden this stuff is being used in some other feature that you never gave your consent for. And then we walk down this path, because what I'm hearing now is that, well, is it for the greater good? Well, I think I should have the right to say whether or not my blood is going to be used for whatever test sample and to what research is going to be used. And it shouldn't be a balancing as to minimum risk for me as to being identified, or maybe an employer who might get the information that found out I had some type of disease that they don't want to cover me in their insurance anymore. Compared to the greater good. I mean, it's almost like I'm wondering how long this practice has been going on. As I said, we looked at this stuff 10 years ago, we're back again, and now we're looking at basically taking what protections, the ones that we put in place in 95, and taking away, whittling more away, and putting it to a federal standard. And it just seems to me we're not being forthright with people when they go in to get tests. I don't know what's been going on in my personal life as to what has been used for research or not, but what I'm hearing is it's common practice to have all this data, and that basically they've stockpiled the data or the samples, and now they're going to do blind research on with it. And then at some point they might want to knock on your door and say, oh, by the way, we did some research and we found out that you got this. Can we learn a little bit about more of your family history? Is that not what we're talking about? It is occurring or could occur?
Senator Burdick, Senator Prezinski, I would say that the scenario that you are painting is not accurate in large part. And I'll have to ask Gwen to help me out here, but there are other provisions in another Senate bill that's being considered that pertain to discrimination, health insurance, etc. Yeah.
Chibberg, Senator Brzezinski, if I can interject briefly. There is existing Oregon law that prohibits the use of genetic information for purposes of insurance underwriting and discriminatory action by your employer. So there are existing laws on the book that do prohibit that behavior that you are concerned about quite legitimately.
That's part of it. I understand. Let's just take that off the table to say that's not going to be dealt with. But you could say at some point, by someone having access to a blood sample that I gave for what I thought was for medical purposes, all of a sudden has now been used for research, them showing up at your door and saying, hey, we're doing this great research project and we noticed through your sample that you had this, this, and this. Would you sit down and talk to us about your family history?
Senator Burdick, Senator Prezinski, the IRB is the body that considers if that could ever happen. And I can let my colleague, who is the head of an IRB, speak to the fact that that is extremely unlikely to happen, because if there was risk that would be associated with a number of the things that you mentioned, that would not be considered minimal risk. For example, if that individual had AIDS, if that person had some other kind of, was a vulnerable population, a member of a vulnerable population, then that is a study that would have far higher protections and would not be considered minimal risk. It is, however, true that information that is collected by the census, by a whole raft of places in our lives where information is collected, can be analyzed, and the trade-off is that it won't be attached to your identity, but it may be used to do some of the studies, for example, that shows the relative risk of heart disease or cancer, so that people are at high risk for deadly diseases can be the beneficiaries of public information campaigns, of making information available to your providers so that they know if people who are overweight by certain proportion of their body weight are at higher risk for heart attacks. Those are the kinds of public good that come only from looking at very, very large databases, where it would not be possible to go back, and because the identity of the individual is not really of interest to that researcher, but only the fact that this person has certain risk factors and certain people die or have higher risks of diagnoses for serious illnesses because they have certain risk factors. And that information becomes available to the public or to your doctor so that risks, medicines can be developed, etc. There's a public good associated with that information. And the researcher is not interested in who you are, but rather that these discoveries can be made.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. A couple of comments and then a question. I think what we're being asked here is to weigh the greater public good against the expectation of personal privacy. In one phrase, that's what we're being asked to weigh here. I know that I've been a part of a medical study, the Harvard Medical Study, for about 40 years now, or 35 years.
Really?
The different part. The part of that. we have an expectation of personal privacy here. However, the fact is that during that study, I mean, there has been a explicit consent all the way through for 35 years, you know. But the question is, I'm a veterinarian, and I spent a lot of years doing herd health stuff with large herds of animals, very large herds of animals. And if a genetic sample could provide diagnosis of a transmissible genetic disease in that scenario, would your ethics require informing the sample provider with that information?
I think all IRBs are individual committees for a center, and so it would vary from IRB to IRB, but I think an IRB taking its job seriously would certainly probably require that there be some sort of follow-up in that circumstance to make sure that somebody was informed. But then there would be a weighing of whether or not that would be damaging information to the person themselves, whether or not they need to know, whether they would want to know that information, mm-hmm. depending on individual circumstances.
So it depends.
It really depends. Okay.
That's a good question, Senator Whitsitt. Okay, I think we're going to bring up our next panel now. Thank you very much. Gary Chiodo and Paul Newton. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senators, my name is Gary Chiodo. I'm the chair of the Oregon Health and Science University IRB. I'm also the director of the OHSU Research Integrity Office. OHSU does a fair amount of genetics research, and hopefully if all goes well with our program to further develop biomedical research at OHSU, we will be doing even more. I wanted to touch on some of the questions that have come up so far, hopefully clarify or add some clarity to those issues, and also touch on the economic impact of the current version of the Genetic Privacy Act. First of all, there have been some questions come up about how information is protected when it is taken out and used for genetic research. We've talked about anonymous or de-identified samples or data. We've talked about coded data. And then you can also have identified data. To come back to Senator Prusansky's question about do pieces of me exist somewhere in a freezer in a pathology lab, and the answer is almost certainly yes, because when a clinical test is done, it is very rare that all of the sample is used, whether it's a blood sample, a tumor biopsy, some other tissue sample. The reason that samples are retained are normally for clinical purposes in case at a future date your healthcare provider would want to go back and retest a portion of that sample. It's very rare that any clinical pathology lab would allow the entire sample to be used up because it may be very valuable for your health to be able to go back and retest it in the future and perhaps compare it with a current sample. So those samples exist, and they exist either with a name on it or a coded identifier. When an investigator comes to us, comes to the IRB and says, I want to obtain several hundred or several thousand samples from this clinical pathology lab from people who have had whatever the diagnosis is, then the IRB would want to know how those samples are identified when they go to the researcher. But the point I want to make is that the privacy or the confidentiality risk exists with the samples currently in the lab, even if no research is ever done with them. If no one ever has a research interest in my samples, then they stay on the shelf, but they stay there with the identifier. When a researcher comes to me and says, I want to use that sample, and I tell the researcher, well, that's fine, but you have to securely code it. You have to keep the decoding sheet separate from the codes on the samples, or you must anonymize it. We've added another layer or two of protection for confidentiality and privacy. We have reduced the risk from those samples staying in the lab with the whatever identifiers they have. If the researcher wants to get identified samples, that is, they would have a direct identifier, someone's name, then the IRB would certainly tell them that they must get specific informed consent from those subjects. On the other hand, that's rarely what researchers need. They don't need identity. They need diagnosis. They need clinical parameters. They need the sample with a number of biological pieces of information attached to it. They do not need to know who it came from whom it came. If the investigator comes to me and says that they want to use samples and they're going to either code them or anonymize them, then at that point the IRB would consider, as my colleagues have already described, the criteria for waiving or modifying consent, criteria that are provided under the Common Rule and under HIPAA. So those are some issues around the risk of the existing samples and how they would be, that risk would be decreased when they come to the to a research purpose. I want to give you a very real-life example. I think everyone has heard of the anti-leukemia pill Gleevec, which was discovered and developed at OHSU by one of our all-star researchers. Gleevec acts by mediating the activity of an entity called the Philadelphia chromosome. Without going into molecular genetics, the word chromosome, of course, implies that this is genetic research. It was, in fact, genetic research. The investigator who invented that drug was looking for a cure for a disease called chronic myelogenous leukemia that kills a large number of people. When he did that, he had to go to the existing pathology repositories and ask for hundreds, if not thousands, of samples, tumor and blood samples, from patients who had been diagnosed with chronic myelogenous leukemia. And he then had to do his genetic research with those samples. He did that pre-Oregon Genetic Privacy Act. Under the current Genetic Privacy Act, I won't tell you that he couldn't do his research, but it would be significantly hampered and probably would take so long that some investigator in another state would have beat us to the punch on that. And in the meantime, there would have been many people who, in fact, died from chronic myelogenous leukemia. And that brings me to my...
For just one half a second.
Yes.
Did Dr. Drucker require names as part of his research or require family information?
Thank you, Senator Burdick. He did not. He did not require any identified samples. He requested and required samples that were securely coded. So if he had to retest a sample or go back, he had the code breaker list, he could break the code and go back to the lab and ask for another part of that sample. So in theory, someone would have been able to trace the sample that he had with the code back to a person, but there were a couple layers of codes to get to that. But he certainly didn't need names or direct identifiers. And in my experience, and I've been an IRB member since 1992, I've been a chair since, for the last 6 years, it is very rare that an investigator who's doing either genetic research or any kind of epidemiological research where they're looking at hundreds of thousands of records, it's very rare that they need names or direct identifiers. They need information. The last point I was going to make is about the economic impact. The economic impact is not just at OHSU or other institutions that are doing genetic research. It's to Oregon as a state. We have already had some of our very best investigators leave OHSU to go to other states that do not have a genetic privacy act that's quite this restrictive. And they've done so taking with them their federal grants, their federal research grants. That has a direct impact on our economy at OHSU and our economy in the state. The other impact, financial impact, is a little more difficult to gauge, but we have a large amount of industry-sponsored research, pharmaceutical companies that are developing new drugs. It is extraordinarily common now for those protocols to include a genetic component because there is almost always a genetic mediator for how drugs work in different people with different genetic makeups. So it's very important to study that. These are multi-site protocols. They're normally going on in 25 or 30 or 40 or more institutions around the United States. It is very rare that an industry sponsor would be willing to alter their protocol just for Oregon. So they write the protocol, and when they find out that, in fact, an alteration would be needed in order to accommodate our Genetic Privacy Act, they bypass us. That, again, is a loss to medical science, but it's also a loss to our economy at the same time.
Thank you. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, my name is Paul Needham. I'm a lawyer at the Public Defender's Office in Portland. And for the past 6 or 7 years, I've also been heavily involved in IRB work. I currently chair the Public Health Department IRB in Portland. I'm on one of Mr. Chiaro's boards up at OHSU, and I'm on the Legacy Health Services IRB. Each IRB does slightly different kind of works. The OHSU IRBs and the Legacies do a lot of clinical work, but also a fair amount of social and behavioral work. The county IRB does a lot of social behavioral work, does a lot of jail studies, things of that sort. I think essentially one thing that we're talking about here with Senate Bill 1025 is the issue of conflict of laws. We have a fairly well-fleshed-out federal system of how IRBs review research that comes to them to get approved. That, as you've heard, that system allows them in certain circumstances when there's minimal risk and other factors to waive informed consent, essentially for the studies that you've kind of heard the examples. These are usually retrospective requests to review records, to gain information that's anonymous information, to look for patterns for scientific research, to develop new findings, scientific findings that can lead to better therapies. What IRBs struggle with is when the laws conflict. And here we have the Oregon Privacy Act, which basically puts a further hurdle for an issue that is fairly common that IRBs deal with, and that is assessing minimal risk. An example, the way minimal risk could be understood is that most of the senators here are drinking coffee or water, and in that bottle that you have, your genetic information is contained in that bottle. If you leave it here today, somebody can pick it up, and if they can identify that it belonged to you, they can gain your genetic information. Right.
Don't pick my water.
So, and as you've heard recently in Oregon law, if you affirmatively claim that bottle, even an empty bottle, at the end of the day there's garbage or your own possession, that's still your property. and that is protected. That genetic information is protected. If you throw it away, it's not. Now, the difference here is that the minimal risk analysis that IRBs do is they sort of look at the information that's contained in what the researcher is looking for, and they ask, is that information such that it creates a greater risk than daily life for the subject? That's the kind of analysis that we go through. And the committees that I'm on, I sit on three committees here in Portland, we're very cognizant of this issue of basically the breach of confidentiality. That is the single most important issue that we face when we're assessing research of either embarrassment or somehow the information of whatever kind is going to be used against the subject in some form. Senator Brzezinski asked questions about following up and contacting subjects that have years before consented to a blood sample or a tissue sample. There's also a breach of confidentiality issues on that. And IRBs struggle with the issue of should we follow up and contact this person and possibly have some family member or some neighbor know that they're now part of a study that involves some difficult disease or something of that sort. So that issue is something that we talk about quite a bit. So what IRBs look for is ways to protect confidentiality, still be able to do the research that's important that has allowed so much new therapies and new devices to come forward. So I think one reason why I'm here today is to talk about the conflict of laws and how the federal system works pretty well in sort of assessing the minimal risk that is to a subject that has long considered for the tissue sample. Now I want to give one example of how of the problem that it raises. We now are starting to see consent forms where a researcher doesn't know what they're going to do with the sample. They may have three or four different research proposals in mind in the next 5 or 6 years. And essentially, they have to ask for informed consent from a subject for a study that they have no idea what the study is going to be about. And so you can put yourself in the subject's place and ask whether they actually want to be part of that research or to give consent to research that may be a benefit to them or society, clinical. I'm basically talking about a clinical practice, or simply to say, no, I don't want to be part of this because I have no idea what you're going to do with my sample. And as you've heard, what really the researchers are trying to are asking us to do is they come to us and say, we want to look at these records of some tissues or some blood that has been taken from years before. We don't want the name, so we don't want to breach privacy. What we want to do is get the information and see whether there's going to be some scientific merit or scientific discovery that comes out of that. There's so much records now that has genetic information that if we are not allowed to do this or it becomes difficult to do it, that research won't be done. And I think most of the people that we see that are involved in studies are people that have some relation to the research that's being done, cancer, leukemia, all types of different studies, that's why they're there. And so it is important for them to know that the research that's going to be done is something that they want done. I think that's one aspect of this bill that's important. So I would ask you to consider this fix. It's a minor fix. And the IRBs are pretty good at assessing the issue of privacy and confidentiality. Thank you.
Okay, so the way I'm hearing you is that if we could figure out a system where the actual sample, the information that's included in the sample, you know, just forget where you got it, would be accessible without consent, but not the information, anything tied to the identifier, to the person. In other words, if you were limited to access simply to the sample and did not have access to the person to look at family history or address or where they live or whatever, would that still provide most of what you need for research?
Yes, that would get us considerably down the path. A sample that's anonymized so that there is no code attached to it, and the investigator receives the sample knowing the diagnosis and any other medical parameters around it, is most often what's needed. In some cases, a coded sample may be needed, again, securely coded with a code breaker list somewhere else stored
separately.
In case
they need to resample?
In case they need to resample, or in case science moves on and they need to go back and look at a portion of that sample again for that person. Because keep in mind what they're looking at is not just the gene itself, not just the DNA, but the product that comes out of that. So Alzheimer's disease research today may look at various proteins made by specific genes in this sample mm-hmm. of someone who's a relative of someone with Alzheimer's. But 3 months from today, there may be 4 new proteins discovered, and they may need to look at the code, go back to the sample, and then look for those new proteins, those new genetic products.
Well, do they need to know that the person is a relative in that research?
In some cases in genetic research, they need to do family trees. So, in fact, to look at the patterns of genetic inheritance, so they don't need to know the name of the person, but they need to know that mother had trait, father did not, gave birth to 3 children with, 2 without, the genders and then their progeny and so forth. So it's important to map out the information that's derived from this genetic research in a family tree.
But you do have some research that, obviously a lot of research subjects who have given consent. So if you combine those who have given consent with access to samples with no tie to who they came from, would that be something that would keep the researchers here in Oregon?
I believe so. In most instances, that would be very helpful. The issue to keep in mind is that in many instances, the samples that are needed, and we're talking about hundreds or thousands of samples, are in a repository, in a clinical repository, and if coding or anonymizing them to use them is not permitted, then in many cases they're simply lost to that research because the person has either passed away or moved on, contact can't be made to get consent. In addition, getting consent from several thousand people for use of a sample.
I understand that from the previous testimony. I'm trying to figure out how we can do the job without with absolutely no risk to someone being identified.
Well, we need to be able to, my feeling is we need to be able to allow investigators to go to IRBs with their protocols and the IRB to determine, applying the common rule in HIPAA, that either anonymizing or securely coding the samples will be sufficient depending on the circumstances of the protocol. And again, doing that is removing a layer of risk because that sample currently exists somewhere with the name on it, and what we're doing is telling the researcher you can have a part of it and take the name off of it.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Question?
Just out of curiosity, do you know about how long these samples are actually kept? Depends on what type of sample it is.
It would depend very much on the type of sample it is and how much of it is left. An example is if you have a tumor removed in a surgical procedure, a biopsy is done, and depending on the size of the tumor, there may be several slices of that sample, if you will, made and then frozen. And then if they are needed later to go back for a clinical purpose, for rediagnosis, they would start to be used up. Depending on the diagnosis and depending on the treatment that the person had, the sample may be indefinitely stored. In some cases, with certain types of treatment, there are FDA regulations on how long information as well as samples have to be stored.
Thank you. Okay, other questions? Thank you very much. And we'll find out how good a job we did at raising all the questions of privacy. We'll call Dave Fedenke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. David Fedenke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. I'll answer your last question first. I think the committee's been doing an excellent job of trying to find its way through this very complex area of the law. I want to start by making clear that the ACLU is a member of the Genetic Privacy Advisory Committee. Our representative on that committee did not vote in support of this bill. If I could, I'm going to try not to repeat anything you've already heard this afternoon. But I think the committee is on the right track in being very sensitive about this proposal in front of you, because genetic samples are different from genetic research is different from other kinds of research. And as the previous witnesses have testified, more and more medical research is becoming genetic research. And as I understand it, from the education I've had on these issues over the years, more and more of that research is being done as coded research. When the legislature last did a major revisit to the issue of genetic privacy in 2001, a number of changes were made to the Oregon law. Prior to that time, anonymous research could be carried out without consent or without notice, and without notice. In 2001, this legislature approved ensuring that no research could be done without at least the individual being given notice that their sample could be used at some time in the future. And that provision currently exists in ORS 192.537, which is the opt-out provision that was referred to earlier. So, Madam Chair, when you were asking your questions about why can't this research be done on an anonymous basis so that the samples are de-identified, I believe the answer is that most of this research that is now being done across the country that involves multiple sites is being done in a coded fashion rather than an anonymous fashion. And to do coded research where it is possible to link back up the information with the person's identity, although it's the research may not be able to do that directly, but it can be done by going back to the source of where the sample came from if they are the ones that hold the key. Current Oregon law requires informed consent for coded research. What we have suggested to the sponsors of this bill is that they add one additional layer of protection to what they're proposing in this bill. We understand that genetic research is moving more and more towards coded research, subject to the Institutional Review Board procedure and the requirements of federal law. But we want to be sure that the persons from whom those samples have been taken are at least notified at the time the sample is taken that their sample in the future may be used for genetic research and be given an opportunity to opt out. Now, in 2001, since the law prior to 2001 had permitted, and let me know if I'm losing you, since prior to 2001, Oregon law had permitted the use of anonymous research, anonymous samples, without any consent or notice, we grandfathered in those samples that were collected prior to 2001 and before the notice requirement was put into effect. Since 2001, presumably. Many samples have been collected, we would hope, where individuals were given notice that their sample could be used for anonymous research, and were given the opportunity to opt out.
Yeah, is that anonymous or also coded?
Only anonymous,
okay,
under current law. And what we have suggested is that at least going forward, that samples that are taken be subject, that we would not oppose allowing those samples to be used for coded research, subject to the kind of safeguards that the proponents of this bill are talking about, as long as the individuals from whom those samples were collected were given notice that the sample could be used for anonymous or coded research, and they were given the opportunity to opt out. The stickier problem is what you do with samples that were collected prior to the effective date of this bill, if you choose to pass it. And that is a problem. You know, I think the proponents of the bill are not happy about having to do an opt-out. Certainly some of the proponents of this legislation didn't support the opt-out in 2001 for anonymous research, because they felt it was too burdensome. We feel very strongly that individuals have a right to be put on notice that biological samples they are giving for medical procedures may be used for genetic research in the future.
Okay, could we get Mr. Kyoto and Mr. Newton back here for a second? Because the opt-out provision for anonymous research, I want to find out if that's being used and what your experience is in terms of how many folks actually opt out.
It is being used since this version of the Genetic Privacy Act went into effect at OHSU. Part of the problem and the reason that it wreaks havoc with some of the genetic research that our investigators need to do is that the majority of samples that are taken for clinical purposes come from providers around the state and some from out of state that do not have consent forms that talk about the possibility of doing genetic research with whatever is left over. It's because the majority of providers are not involved in doing research. They're strictly clinicians taking care of patients. So we have a number of instances where samples that exist in clinical pathology laboratories have been collected with the opt-out advice being given because they come from a place like Kaiser or OHSU or a research hospital. Those go into, I'm speaking metaphorically now, those go into one freezer for the people who have been told about the opt-out provision and did not opt out. We have a second freezer then for those who have been told about the opt-out provision and did opt out. We have a third provision for those whose samples were collected before there was an opt-out provision under the blanket informed consent. And then we have a fourth freezer for those who were never told about the opt-out provision. Again, if you're looking at especially a disease that may be rare, you may need to collect samples from all four of those freezers in order to do your research. We need to have the IRB have the authority returned to the IRB to apply the common rule in HIPAA to how those samples are protected, whether they're anonymized or securely coded, but in fact they may be used for genetic research regardless of the opt-out provision. We need the opt-out provision ideally to go away so those samples may be used with appropriate protection on confidentiality.
What percentage of folks would you say opt out of the people who are offered that chance?
I do not know, and I hesitate to guess for you.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Okay. Mr. Fidanki, did you have any other?
I just had one other comment, Madam Chair, which is that the reason that the we believe the legislature has been very sensitive to these issues in the past, and why ACLU is very concerned about these privacy protections, is that genetic material, even when it's anonymous, can theoretically be traced back to an individual if there is a database of DNA identifiers that it can be run against. As we move forward in time, that will be more and more possible as genetic samples are taken from more and more people for identification purposes. And of course, genetic information doesn't only disclose information about an individual, it also discloses information about all of that individual's blood relatives.
Right. I guess the problem is, and this unfair to ask you to comment on this, but it's really a question of privacy versus whether we want to have the research not be in Oregon. Because
and if there is some middle ground, Madam Chair, that might allow both to happen.
Correct. Well, I'd like to continue trying to find that middle ground. I'm not interested in having Gleevec discovered somewhere else. That was an incredible accomplishment for OHSU and for Oregon. So I'd like to keep discussing seriously how we can reach a compromise that will protect people and still allow the research to be done here. Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Whitsitt.
Mr. Bedenke. You know, practically speaking, informed consent requires being properly informed, which is a process that this committee has just listened to for 90 minutes without consensus. So I think that when you say, well, we just fill out one more form and you go to the hospital or go to the doctor or whatever, I'm not sure that means an awful lot. And I think that the debate has to, in my mind, needs to be focused on can we provide adequate privacy by coding, because I really don't think filling out one more form before the fact, and the testimony has pretty much said that after the fact, getting a informed consent individually for each sample that you want to use is not really possible, economically possible, or even sometimes even physically possible. But I think just filling out one more form ahead of time doesn't resolve the issue for me. I don't know if you've been to a hospital recently, but the pile of forms that you initial, no one reads, no one goes over, and if they did, you'd be there all day.
Sure, Senator Whitsitt. We're really not talking about informed consent here. We're talking about an exception that would allow samples to be used without notice to the individual, much less consent.
Yes, I know that.
I think, what you need to understand is that more and more research is being done without informed consent, that the exceptions, particularly with regard to genetic research, because of the large number of samples needed, are being done not only without consent, but without any notice to the individuals from whom the samples were taken. And I think that's a different matter entirely. If you're completely comfortable with the Institutional Review Board procedure, I would submit to you that IRBs have made mistakes. They've made big mistakes in the past, even some here in Oregon. I think the committee would be wise to move very cautiously in this area, because this bill in front of you will not most likely be the exception that swallows the rule. That's all. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you two for coming back up. Appreciate it. This is a complicated issue, committee. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 1025, and I would like the parties to continue working on this. I want to see if we can reach a compromise in our lifetime.
which may be very short.
And now we will open. Yeah, it's a tough decision because everybody benefits from the research, and yet some people are very nervous about the privacy. We will now open a work session. Oh, before I go on to this, we are going to put over the other genetic privacy issue, Senate Bill 99, because we don't yet have the final amendment to it, but we will take that up most likely on Thursday. So we roll that over on Thursday. And we will now open a work session on Senate Bill 333. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is
Senator Ringo's bill. It would increase the maximum amount of damages that may be pled in smaller tort actions for which the court must award attorney's fees to a prevailing plaintiff. There should be a dash 3 in your packet. The dash 3 makes several changes, some of which were recommended by the folks that testified at the public hearing on this matter several weeks ago. Basically, what the dash 3 does is require that the written demand, that is the pre-claim demand made by the plaintiff, be delivered to the defendant or the defendant's liability insurer. It also requires certain specific documentation of the injury or damage. In the case of personal injury, it requires a copy of medical records or bills that are sufficient to reasonably appraise the defendant of the nature and scope of the injuries claimed. And in the case of property damages, it requires documentation of the repair of the property or a written estimate of the change in value to the property. The biggest thing that this bill does is increase, and this was in the original bill, it increases the amount of damages that can be pled in this sort of a tort claim for which prevailing plaintiff attorney fees are available. Currently, that amount is $5,500, and this bill would raise that amount to $7,500.
Thank you, counsel. I had temporarily forgotten that this was Senator Ringo's bill, so we're going to hold that explanation. I'm going to close this, the work session, or recess the work session on Senate Bill 333 with the intention to reopen it when Senator Ringo is back, and we will now open a work session on Senate Bill 913.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 913 is the bill that came from the Criminal Justice Commission.
Well, let's make him stay for this one, then we'll take it up. Thank you.
This bill originally came from the Criminal Justice Commission, and what this measure would do would apply to individuals who are placed into a public institution who are receiving benefits, state benefits, due to a serious mental illness. Under current law, these individuals have their Oregon Health Plan benefits terminated altogether, and what that results in is at least a 90-day period of reapplication once the person is released from the public institution, be it a local jail or prison. This bill would change that to require the Department of Human Services to suspend rather than terminate the medical assistance of a person with a serious medical illness who becomes an inmate at a public institution. There is a dash 3 amendment before you that explains some of the critical terms in the bill. One of the critical terms is public institution, which is defined as a state hospital, local correctional facility, Department of Corrections institution, or youth correctional institution. The other critical term that is defined by the dash 3 amendment is serious mental illness. And that is going to be defined under the dash 3 as a person who is diagnosed by a psychiatrist or a licensed clinical psychologist or a certified non-medical examiner as suffering from one of the following major disorders, dementia, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression, or other affective disorder, or a psychotic mental disorder other than a disorder caused primarily by substance abuse. There's also an exclusion under this definition, and that it does not apply to individuals who are residing at the state hospital who are under the age of 22 or over the age of 65. The reason that this exclusion was written in was to ensure that the state hospital who is caring for those folks can continue to receive Medicaid payments through the federal government. And Mr. Nickel and Ms. Kimball are here, who know a whole lot more about the subject, if there are any questions that I can't help you with.
Okay, and Council, just to clarify this, with the dash 3 amendment, we won't need the dash 1 and 2, right?
That's correct. They replace the earlier attempts to clear up these definitional issues.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee of Council?
Is this bill going to go away in Means, or is that...
Actually, I don't believe this has a subsequent referral.
Madam Chair, there is no subsequent referral. I'm double-checking to see if I've received a fiscal impact, but I don't believe I have yet.
It seems like there will be a cost.
And I might suggest that Mr. Nickel could possibly speak to that. I think he would be instrumental in LFO's formulating of any fiscal impact, and I know that these definitional terms that comprise the dash 3, I think these words were very carefully chosen by the parties with fiscal impact in mind.
Thank you. Mr. Nickel, why don't you come on up and see if you can help with this recurring question we seem to have on these issues in this committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Nickel, and I'm the administrator for the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services in the Department of Human Services. The department has thoroughly reviewed the Dash 3 amendments for fiscal impact, and I believe the impact was $5,500. So that's a minimal, and we would expect to be able to absorb that kind of an impact in order to do this. So.
And I suppose one of the reasons for that is that typically when people get out of an institution, they reapply. So this isn't a question of cutting them off. It's a question of a gap. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. In the state hospital, the social workers have enough of intensive workload in relationship with the patients and know ahead of time when they're going to be discharged, so that we're able, in effect, to do this already. So the impact on the state hospital, frankly, is not all that great from this. I think in the Department of Corrections, where the workloads are, you know, one worker to 200 people, it's frankly of greater benefit there to allow benefits to simply be suspended rather than terminated.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Nickel, a follow-up question. It's also true, isn't it, that the way that the person with serious mental illnesses would be defined under the Dash 3 makes it very likely that these are individuals who are already receiving the benefits that we're talking about anyway?
Madam Chair, Mr. O'Leary, that would be correct.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Witt, do you have a question?
Just an observation, I guess. It seems with the number of people being released from either institution with severe medical illness, it seems ludicrous it would take 90 days to reinstate a policy. It seems ludicrous that we would need to write a bill to do that instead of somebody just using some common sense.
Thank you, Senator Wissett. I agree. Senator Brzezinski.
Yeah, and Senator Wissett, we also have a six-month waiting period for those who go in custody from Oregon Health Plan. And so basically when they're picked up for X number of days and then they're released, if they were on the plan, they're off for 6 months, which incurs all those other health costs.
Thank you very much. Senator Starr, we have before us the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 913.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 913.
Senator Starr has moved Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 913. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Senator Chair, I move Senate Bill 913. The floor to do pass recommendation as amended.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 913 as amended to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Witsit, would you like to carry this? Thank you. Okay, now we will resume the work session, reopen the work session to Senate Bill 333. Because, Senator Ringo, I wanted to give you a chance to say something about this before we...
Thank you. Chair, this is a bill that we heard earlier, and there was a representation from the
Trilawyer Association, also Billy Sine here, who's in the audience from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers, OADC. What's that stand for?
Oregon Association of Defense Counsel.
Of defense
civil side, not.
Thank you, yes. Thank you very much. Who came and expressed some concerns, and so there was a group working on amendments that at least satisfies the concerns of both sides of that. As far as whether the insurance industry is on board, I don't know, but the defense lawyers apparently are fine with this bill. With the Dash 3 amendments.
Correct.
And briefly, is what the Dash 3 amendments do is they clarify that in making the demand letter, there has to be information provided that reasonably apprises the recipient as to the nature and scope of the injury so that they're not completely blindsided. So the bottom line is the value goes up from $5,500 to $7,500, but additional information must be included that I think actually is an appropriate balance. One of the things that I wanted to be clear about these amendments is that with the Dash 3 amendments, information must be provided that reasonably apprises the recipient of the nature and scope of the claim. It's not necessary that every piece of paper that could possibly be part of a medical record be included, but rather just a reasonableness standard so that the person receiving it understands the nature and scope of the claim.
Okay. Any other questions of counsel or Senator Ringo? Senator Ringo, thank you for working with people to make this a good compromise. Senator Starr, do you have an opinion on the Dash 3 amendments?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 333.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 333. Is there discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Starr?
Move Senate Bill 333 as amended. The floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 333 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Senator Byer.
The plaintiffs and the defense attorneys may like it, but I still think it's the same thing. You know, exact same issue is still there, so I'm going to oppose the bill as amended.
Objection noted. Clerk, will you call the roll?
Senator Byer?
No.
Senator Pazanski?
Aye.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye.
Five ayes, two nays.
Senate Bill 333 is, as amended, is passed the Senate floor. Senator Ringo, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
Okay, now we will open a work session on.
Madam Chair.
Senator Barr.
I'll serve notice of intent for minority report on Senate Bill 333.
A minority report?
Oh, fun.
So noted. Are you open to suggestions on what it might say?
Possibly.
What's the relating problem?
Attorney's fees for tort claims a specified amount.
Okay.
I think there is.
Tomorrow. Somebody's too bored tomorrow.
Three people signed up. Yes. Okay, in our now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 265.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 265 originally comes to you from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. They have asked that if the bill is amended that their name be taken off in the printing process. You have the Dash 1 amendments in front of you. What they do, they allow the defense to charge a criminal trespass in the first or second degree that the person who entered the premise of dwelling 1 entered or remained upon the area that was open to the public at the time of entry, and 2 entered or remained for the purposes of making personal service or personal delivery of a legal document in the manner required by law. And you have...
Okay, we have signed up for this Laura Smith and Aaron Crow. and Matt Marquis. Let's take everybody here at once.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill today. We are here to propose the Dash 1 amendments, which remove all language in the current bill, and put some language in there that does exactly what counsel mentioned. It gives process servers a defense to being on people's property as long as they're in a public area, let's say a driveway or a walkway.
You identify yourself.
Sorry. Laura Smith with Dave Barrows and Associates here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Process Servers. So once again, this allows a process server to be on private property as long as they're in areas that are open to the public, let's say a driveway, a walkway, a front porch, and are also serving a legal document. The reason we brought this language to you today is there's been a problem in the past when a process server actually gets assaulted when they're attempting to serve process. In most cases, DAs are not willing to go and prosecute for assault because they say that process servers have no more right to be on people's public property than anybody else, and because of that are reluctant to go and prosecute. So this just gives a defense for these guys to be on people's property when they are attempting to serve. With me today is Aaron Crow, the president of the Oregon Association of Process Servers, to talk to you a little bit more about the problem.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members. I am president of the Oregon Association of Professional Process Servers. Private process servers have been serving in Oregon for about 60 years. The process server is faced with the single most important act in litigation. I didn't do that. Aaron Crow, A-A-R-O-N-C-R-O-W.
He did, Dale. That was not your fault. Thank you. I'm sorry about that.
But I believe the single most important act in any litigation is the commencement of the action and obtaining jurisdiction over the individual by serving a paper. Since I entered the business of process service about 20 years ago, millions of documents have been served by private process servers in that time. The overwhelming majority of these are served without any incident. However, a very small percentage, but yet frequent enough, assaults exist deserving of, I think, our attention. What's remarkable about serving process and assault is that it seems to occur almost without exception while the process server is leaving. And, you know, I can go on with Steve Black getting lacerated in the back of the neck, Darlene Otta, who's about 5'4", about 55 years old when this happened, was slammed to the concrete from behind as she was down near the sidewalk. Floyd Bennett, who is about 60, a little over 60, just an amiable person. In fact, he recalls the conversation at the time of the service being very pleasant. Was slammed to the ground, injuring his knee from behind. Bill King punched with a fist in his neck as he is leaving. It always occurs while they're leaving. Has to do, you know, it's act of passion, whatever it is, giving rise to the case finds expression at that moment. Some people have greater impulse control than others, and it finds expression at that moment. As a practical matter, we're officers of the court, but technically we're not. The concept of officer of the court does not pass from attorney to process server in connection with their job of commencing the action. But in the words of Marion County Circuit Court Judge Burton a few weeks ago, she indicated the process server has no more rights to be there than anyone else. And that case was tossed against a homeowner who pulled a gun on a young lady who was there to serve process, put it right between her eyes, and told her that he was going to pull the trigger. She thought she was going to die. She backed up very slowly and started to run. He says, I'm pulling the trigger in 5 seconds. Anyhow, the issue of trespass came up. That was adequate defense. case was tossed. What we seek here is safe passage off the property. That's what we're looking for. There are a few different types
Senator
of...
Senator Brzezinski?
I understand what you're here for. I've spoken to your lobbyist. I've got to tell you, I think we're setting up more potential for conflict. I don't see where this bill, even if it passed, is going to give anyone, quote-unquote, more safe passage if they're dead.
In each of the assault matters that I described earlier, because of the trespassing issue on a homeowner's property, because of that issue, it went nowhere. Wouldn't be prosecuted.
May I, Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski? One clarification that I neglected to make earlier. If a private property owner demands that you get off their property, the process server has to leave immediately. If it's posted that it's private property and no trespass, they're not allowed to go on. So it won't change that. They'll still, as soon as the person demands they leave, they will be required to leave the property.
There are other circumstances for where we can't get support from the sheriff's department because where, for instance, say trustees notice a sale. Now, in the state of Oregon, it used to be that you had to serve everybody. Now you just have to give personal notice to the homeowner because the possibility exists that the people living there would have no other way of knowing that the house is in foreclosure, renters. We knock on the door, nobody's there. We've been there a couple of times. Doesn't look like anybody's there. Obviously, it's lived in. We go back to the car. Now, this is interesting that it's happened quite a bit. The process server will be in the car mapping out their next service. All of a sudden, the deputy sheriff pulls up who was given a call by somebody in the house. Deputy process server will come out. The deputy will make sure they stay at the curb while they're up at the door. They go up to the door. Somebody opens it, surprisingly, and they close the door. Deputy comes back and says, yep, that's them, but they don't want what you have, and you are trespassing, and you can't come back. Now, a lot of deputy sheriffs or a lot of sheriff's department in this state will not serve a trustee's notice of sale because it's non-judicial, and they've effectively stopped the foreclosure process. And we are trespassing if we return.
Madam Chair, I mean, even with this, and you have, quote unquote, the right to be there, if they're not going to accept it, all I see is more volatility just creating because you're going to knock on the door, they're not going to answer, or they're going to come out, and as your lawyer has said, they're going to tell you to leave. Your person's going to say, but I don't have to. I have free passage here. And then we're just going to have more conflict.
The mechanism, as I view it, would be that the officer would then be inclined to take us to the door.
Well, I don't think this bill gives free passage to anybody. It says you can't assault a process server. I mean,
that's what the assault statute says.
Yeah.
Just like the harassment.
Well, that. But as we heard the testimony that they have been interpreting that as...
That's correct. Judges are just not... prosecutors are not willing to prosecute it. They're telling me because judges will just throw it out. In the Marion County instance, there was two reasons that they threw the case out. One, because they said that, you know, the processor didn't have any more right to be there than anyone else. And then the second reason was because they just threatened violence. Violence actually wasn't carried out. And that was the reason the two reasons why that case was thrown out. So in talking to DA, that's my understanding of the situation and several prosecutors. So this will just help to at least establish when assault charges are filed. I talked to Aaron a little bit about what you brought up as far as escalating violence, and I said I think your association is going to definitely have to do some education if this bill passes and make sure that people understand that when they say get off my property, they still have to get off the property. This just provides a defense once an assault case does go to court. So it would be the association's plan, I think, to do education around this.
That's correct.
Before you go on, counsel, did you
Mr. Crow, let's assume this bill passed, and let's assume that you came to someone's house, and there was a sign at the gate, was the gate closed, and the sign said no trespassing.
No trespassing.
Would you feel that this bill, if enacted, would give you the right to proceed further?
Absolutely not, sir. Okay,
thanks.
No. In fact, there would, we would launch an active as part of our educational program within our association. It's our job to keep things from getting out of control. We assume that tensions are heightened by the time we get there.
But if you can't go on their property when it says no trespassing, mm-hmm. then you're not. Then you're in effect saying that you are just like anyone else.
Well, yes. we're looking for a defense when we are leaving and are assaulted.
Madam Chair, what they're looking for is a means to deal with enforcement that Marion County DA's office, for whatever reason, has chosen not to file these cases. I mean, I'd love to see the other counties that are not doing this, because I know in my jurisdiction we would file these if the case was right.
Washington County, Clackamas County, Multnomah County, and Marion County. Those are the four counties involved in, well, pardon me, and also Yamhill County, are counties that view all of this the same. Trespassing is an excellent defense to doing virtually anything you want to somebody else in your property.
Madam Chair.
Senator Podesky.
Sub 2 under Section 2 says enter or remain for the purposes of making personal service or personal delivery of a legal document in a manner required by law. That is the ingredients of a conflict, because you're going to get people that are going to think that they have the right to now stay on the property to carry out the service. You're going to have a homeowner for whatever reason that gets ticked off, and you're going to have a confrontation, and someone's going to get hurt very seriously. And they're not going to be, I mean, it just seems to me that they already have the ability to have enforcement through the current assault harassment statutes. And just because you have some DAs that are just deciding arbitrarily not to file those cases, I think we're going to be setting these people up who think they're going to have greater power than they really do. And if they're on the wrong end of a gun, it's not going to make any difference.
Well, I don't think... I mean, I don't think that people would go on the rampage either way on this, but...
Well, the last thing in the world that any of our members in Oregon are interested in is, once we see tensions get to a point where even they're shouting, we don't remain. We don't want to be there. By that time, the papers are usually already served. If we're talking to somebody, we've served them. The problem is when they aren't coming to the door, we're not talking about going in places where the public is not normally allowed either. We're not talking about going around the house. We're talking about going to the porch and making sufficient attempts at service to actually affect service.
I'm going to cut you off there to give Mr. Marquis a chance to just say something really quick because we're out of time.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing the Oregon Collectors Association. The members of our association tend to be high users of process servers, and the issues that you've heard prior to me are becoming more and more of a problem, and we're hopeful that this amendment will attempt to try to solve that problem. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you. We'll close the hearing.
Thank you.
And we will put until tomorrow Senate Bill 97 and 965 and the ones that were postponed from Thursday, Senate Bill 546 and 568, until tomorrow's thrill-packed agenda. And Senate Judiciary is adjourned.